Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Kawaski.
Welcome to today's edition of the Social Network Show. I am your host, Jane Karwoski, Dr. J, and I am an experimental psychologist fascinated by how this networked, connected world is changing human life before our very eyes. My co-host is Jim Nico, CEO of our parent company, Social Network Intermedia, LLC. Today, we welcome back Dr. Katie Davis, co-author, along with Howard Gardner, of The App Generation, based on their research on how three generations look at information technology. She's on the faculty of the University of Washington's Information School. Welcome to the Social Network Show, Katie.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's wonderful to be here.
Welcome back, Katie. We love your work.
Thank you.
And thanks very much for fitting us in before your trip to Berlin. And Dr. Davis, for today, I thought we could go into the metaphorical use of app. You mentioned on our last visit during our live show on News Talk 720 KDWN. If I have it right, it's the idea that because of the constant use of apps, the digital native is used to and expects explicit step-by-step instructions, an algorithm, on how to do or understand just about anything. Now, as a college instructor, I see this every semester, but I'm not sure it's new. For example, instead of the traditional term paper or two, I have students create a timeline on a site called, seriously, tikitalki.com. Mm-hmm. Into which they place the major contributors to the history of psychology, along with watershed events and some entries to set the context of the times. And before assigning timelines, I had students do mind maps of the course content. Wow, talk about anxiety and confusion. However, there were artistically inclined students who loved the mapping, and the timeline graphics seemed to appeal to a subgroup of students also. Whereas, you know, the more traditional didactic approaches follow what I call the tyranny of the left hemisphere. But how would you describe it?
So, you know, it's funny. Actually, I'm going to have to try out that tiki-taki. That sounds really interesting.
It is fun.
Yeah. Well, you know, so this kind of comes back to our metaphor of the app mentality. And throughout the book, we kind of go in and out of speaking about apps metaphorically, but also, you know,
literally,
mm-hmm. Right. And so when it comes to education and how students of today approach their work and their assignments, this is sort of where we bring in the metaphorical vision of apps and the app mentality. And it's really the idea that young people expect immediate answers and very concrete and definitive answers. There's not a whole lot of comfort with just sort of living, sitting for a while with ambiguity, mm-hmm. or complex questions that don't immediately suggest a very definitive answer. And you can draw parallels to technology and apps in particular. So if you think about how you use apps, it's usually to perform a very discrete, finite task where you're looking for an answer. So if you're looking for a coffee shop, or if you're looking for somewhere to print or mail something, or to do your banking, you know, you open up the appropriate app and you are, you know, you accomplish your task immediately. And there's no sort of ambiguity. There's only pretty much one reason why you're using that app. And so that's the sort of algorithmic way of thinking that we talk about in the book. And we can see parallels in that kind of thinking when we look at how students today approach their work. But I wouldn't say that it's caused by technology. I think that it's probably supported and reinforced by the way youth use technology, but I think really the changes over the last 20 years in the education system itself and also in the economy probably have more to do with the way young people approach their school and their work now.
Okay, so the app eliminates the need or the existence of ambiguity. And what I'm interested in that last statement you made, that there were changes in the educational system that would be reinforcing this also. Can you describe what you mean by that?
Sure. So we did this research at an education school at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. And so we very much took an education perspective. And actually, a big chunk of our research involved conducting numerous focus groups with longtime educators who'd been teaching in a variety of different schools and also in after-school programs. Mm-hmm. And they told us that over the last 20 years, and, you know, we know this as well through our own practical experiences and also just knowledge of how policy has changed, but you know, there's an increased focus on high-stakes testing, you know, really starting with the publication in the early 80s of A Nation at Risk and then translating into No Child Left Behind Act that mandated that kids take standardized testing and pass, meeting annual yearly progress. And then now Obama's Race to the Top, it all very much focuses on standardized testing, high-stakes testing. And the result of that is that teachers are feel pressure to arrange the curriculum and how they teach towards helping their students pass the test.
What did you call that high fix?
High test? Stakes?
High stakes.
Okay.
Yeah, high stakes testing.
So, okay,
yeah.
So you either make it or you don't type of...
Right, and those are high stakes both for students and for teachers. So if the students aren't passing, they may not graduate to the next year. And if teachers don't get their students to pass the test, they may be out of a job.
And the school might be downgraded, or the school district.
Absolutely, or the school could be, you know, taken over and all of the teachers replaced.
Hi. That's pretty high stakes.
It's very high stakes, and it really isn't conducive to any sort of risk-taking in education. And so, you know, students feel that anxiety. I myself was a fourth grade teacher, and I've been in a lot of schools at all grade levels over the last 10 years, and you can feel the anxiety. They know that getting the right answer is the goal. But of course, that's not the goal of education. The goal of education is learning and failing and learning from your failures and your mistakes. But unfortunately, that's not the way we've set up our education system now.
Interesting. So in essence, then, you say students are, you can even feel the anxiety.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, that you can even, in comments that they make, like, well, will this be on the test? Or mm-hmm. what if this kind of question shows up on one of those standardized tests? And, you know, it really so much of the teaching, particularly in public schools, and particularly actually in public schools that are serving low-income kids, really the focus is on these are the types of questions you're going to get on the test. You better be ready to answer them.
Is there any anecdote for that? I mean, I know that it's a different way of looking at education for sure, but is there anything you can do to calm the kids down?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. If I had my way and if Howard has his way, we would just overhaul the whole standardized testing and just create room. I mean, there are schools, and unfortunately, they're usually for more privileged kids, in the private schools where they're not as beholden to these tests. And there's just a lot more freedom to explore and to go down one avenue, and then maybe it doesn't lead anywhere, so then you go down another avenue. One thing I do see, actually, I've done a lot of work recently in after-school settings, and they're much more open and free, and there's really a lot more time for the teachers of these after-school programs to let kids, you know, go off in their own directions and, you know, riff on something that is really interesting to them or something that's on their mind. And, of course, that's the best kind of teaching, and that's the kind of teaching that the great John Dewey would have thought was the best as well, the real constructivist kinds of teaching.
The idea of constructivist teaching, I saw that in your materials a couple of times, many times. Can you describe that or define that for us?
Sure. I mean, there's really a tension in education, and there has been for decades, between constructivist ways of teaching that really endorse leading in an open-ended way, leading discussions, and building off of kids' personal interests and helping them to connect what interests them inherently to other topics in the world. And that's very much in the spirit of John Dewey from the early 20th century, Montessori. There's a wonderful set of schools in Italy, in Reggio Emilia, that, you know, they may spend a week just talking about butterflies, but from all different perspectives. And so that's the type of open-ended, constructive type of teaching that I endorse and most of my education colleagues also endorse. And that's highly contrasted with more closed-ended, teach-to-the-test types of instruction. But I guess you could probably draw a direct line to Skinner and behaviorism in psychology, and this idea that, you know, positive reinforcement, negative mm-hmm. reinforcement, very, very clearly defined tasks. There's a right answer, there's a wrong answer. You get points for the right answer, you don't get any points for the wrong answer. There's not a lot of freedom there. Yeah.
Well, let's go into that a little bit deeper. I especially want to talk about the freedom involved and what kind of things are being required of the kids to learn. And so that's what I'd like to talk a bit more about in our next segment.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
Kelly Keller, an intellectual property attorney specializing in internet law and social media issues. Join me on The Kelly Keller Show right here on the Social Network Station. Together with my guests, we will tackle tough legal problems presented by the ever-increasing use of social media in everyday business. Through dynamic conversations, we will discuss your rights and responsibilities in the new media world so the hard work you have put into developing your brand, business, and products does not go to waste. How does the law's response to the social media explosion affect you? Join me on The Kelly Keller Show to learn more.
Now, back to The Social Network Show.
Welcome back to The Social Network Show, where we are talking with Dr. Katie Davis of the University of Washington and author of The App Generation, along with Howard Gardner of Harvard Graduate School of Education. And that is where you got your doctoral degree in education, right, Dr. Davis?
That's correct. Yeah.
What I wanted to ask you about was the type of questions. I saw a few samples from some of the standardized questions in English, I believe, and I was just amazed that I hope it was an aberration, not typical, but it had to do with, you know, defining literary devices. And this was in grade school. And there are words that most adults probably wouldn't know today. And it's more about like onomatopoeia and that type of literary devices. And it seemed to me that the focus in the standardized testing approach is learning about something rather than learning to do it. Would you agree on that?
Well, that's an important distinction, and I agree that a lot of tests and standards do have that emphasis on content, which is unfortunate because it suggests that kids' brains are these vessels that need to be filled with content. Uh-huh. But really, what needs to happen is their minds need to be exercised, and they need to be kind of rewired in some instances, or certain muscles need to be worked in others so that they can think in new ways. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that focus on content is not ideal. I will say, however, that there are some new standards, for instance, in science education, the next generation of science standards, and they really have tried to focus not so much on content, although there is some of that focus, but also on how ways of being a scientist or just different ways of inquiry and knowing. And I think that's a positive step, and that's a step in the right direction. It still, however, doesn't take away that anxiety about high-stakes testing. Whether or not the tests are good or not, there's still going to be that anxiety around it. So it's kind of two problems there.
Now, one of the reasons this has all come about is because the United States has been lagging behind a lot of other countries in science and the STEM classes, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Now, maybe those countries that are leading in those fields, are they using the high-stakes testing approach, or are they using the more constructivist approach?
That's an interesting question, and I think an interesting country to look at might be Finland, and they've got outstanding results in all areas pretty much in education. They've got a famously very successful education system, and at the same time, they have no mandated standardized tests. So, you know, I think that says a lot probably, where their focus is not on teaching to a particular test, but making sure that every single child is engaged and learning at his or her own pace.
And in their interest area, from what I recall, that Finland has a wonderful way of developing vocational skills for those who want to follow that. In other words, they don't act as if every child should go to college.
Yes, that's right. And really just making sure that youth are engaged in what interests them. And that's really the best kind of learning, is starting with one's personal interests. You know, it's really interesting when you think about the contrast between constructivist ways of teaching versus the more closed-ended, behaviorist ways of teaching. In the research for our book, we came across this really interesting study that was done by a psychologist, Elizabeth Bonowitz, with young kids. And it actually, she didn't use technology at all, but I think it really signifies and represents this app mentality. So just in a nutshell, what she did is she had little kids, probably about age 3 or 4, come into the lab, and half of them were put in randomly into one group, the other half randomly into another group. And they were given this very strange-looking toy. It had all sorts of bells and whistles on it, literally, and, you know, squeaky things. And, you know, they've never seen any toy quite like this before. In one of the groups, the experimenter, she showed the child exactly how to use the toy and play with it, and then gave the child the toy to play with. In the other group, the experimenter started to show how to use the toy, but then was somehow called away and and just left the child to play with a toy. And what they found, so here you've got set up a very closed-ended way of using a toy versus a very open-ended way. What they found is the kids who were not shown how to use a toy played with it for longer, and they came up with a wider range of ways to use the toy. The kids who were shown how to use it weren't as interested in it. They didn't spend as long. And I think that really does go to show that this difference between being shown exactly how to do something versus being able to explore. And it's really much richer, and it's a much richer learning experience if you're able to do the latter.
If I can play another side of this coin for a second, okay? I'm a layman sitting in the audience, and I'm thinking about my father who has to have surgery, and I'm wondering, well, I mean, there's no testing for a surgeon. I mean, in other words, I'm questioning I get the idea, this freewheeling, educational, what you're interested in aspect or phenomenon. But on the other hand, where does testing come in? I mean, if someone's going to be a great surgeon, don't they need to be tested all along the way before they actually go into the operating room and operate on me?
Absolutely. So we're not saying, and certainly I think there are certain professions that you really, really want to make sure that the person knows their stuff. You know, a surgeon is a perfect example. A pilot is another example where we really hope that they've been tested very carefully and they've proven that they know how to do it. At the same time, though, in both of those examples, a surgeon and a pilot, there are points where actually one of the most important things they may do is use their own discretion and their own judgment in a very difficult, ambiguous situation that they weren't anticipating, and it's how they respond in that situation that may save one or more lives. So that's sort of, your point is absolutely well taken, but you also, even in those probably extreme cases, there is still a role for the more open-ended education.
Thank you.
Well, in response to that, too, I'm not quite as convinced because what we're talking about on both of those examples is procedural knowledge as opposed to declarative. Declarative being just the facts and something you would put, you know, answers on a test, whereas teaching those things are basically an apprentice model where someone who knows how to do it and is skilled at it can be alongside someone who is not as skilled. But they have the foundation of the facts and the knowledge with which they then need to act very creatively, like you say, especially in situations where there's some improvisation required. And to, you know, then again, the ability to think on your feet. But so I think there's that layer of knowledge, but how are we going to be able to apply it and be creative in applying it if we're just stuck in the closed-ended, the apps that tell us exactly how to do it? And the example with the children, I think, is wonderful. The creativity can come out when they're not told exactly how to do something.
Exactly. And, you know, there's another element to this, and it's not just education. It's also the economy. So once kids graduate from college or high school, they know that they face a very, very challenging job market. Mm-hmm. And taking big risks in those circumstances, you know, is very dangerous, just practically speaking. So that's another element where it's very hard to get a job. There's growing income inequality. We've got a winner-take-all society where only a few get a lot, and then the rest don't get as much, or they really have to struggle for what they have. And so that really isn't an environment that's very conducive to sort of risk-taking, and it really does favor toeing the line and getting the right answer. And so that's another element that we talk about in the book.
So what is your suggestions? What are they for combating this situation? It's multifaceted. I imagine the solution has to be also.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there are many different levels that you could work on for this. So at the policy level, I think that's probably one of the most challenging is how do we change the current policy landscape in the education system? To me, it doesn't seem to be changing anytime soon. In fact, it just seems to be getting more towards standardized testing. But, you know, hopefully, I would hope that at the level of the school and the classroom, teachers and administrators can try at least to carve out some time, and it may be during the school day, it may be after, for more open-ended explorations. And, you know, right now, iPads are really becoming popular in a lot of school districts, and they're being introduced. And there's an opportunity to really be very mindful about what kinds of apps you're going to download onto those iPads to engage students. Are they going to be very closed-ended, teach-to-the-test types of apps? And unfortunately, I've seen a lot of examples of those. Mm-hmm. Or are they going to be more open-ended apps that allow for exploration? And there are definitely, I've come across some examples of those, but not as many.
Well, I hope you can recommend those to the education establishment, you might say, and so that the teachers know what they are and why they are more open-ended and how to use them in the classroom. That's always a big challenge. Thank you so much, Dr. Davis, for joining us today. We've been talking with Katie Davis from the University of Washington, author of The App Generation, How Today's Youth Navigate Identity, Intimacy, and Imagination in a Digital World. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Davis.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you for listening. We hope you add us to your iTunes or Stitcher.com favorites playlist so that you can automatically receive each show with our wonderful guests and important topics. Please get in touch with us via the contact link on thesocialnetworkshow.com, where you can listen to more interviews and read the latest on our blog. You'll also be able to replay our live show from 5 p.m. Sundays on News Talk 720 KDWN at the foot of our homepage. And follow us on Twitter at SocialNetShow, as well as hear the show on Stitcher.com or iTunes. Please have fun and be safe, online and off, until we can welcome you here again.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on The Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.